This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Really want to thank you for coming. This is Exploring a Cleometric History of the University of California. And someone asked me what cleometric meant, and it's Cleo is in the goddess of life and history, and then metric, which is using data. And this was a very popular or a growing area in the field of history, really in the 80s, I think, maybe? I don't know, 70s. Okay, it became very a dominant component. A lot of economists were being recruited into history, I think, at that time. But in any case, that's its reference point. And just to say, I'm John Douglas. I'm at the Center for Studies in Higher Education, and I have written on the history of higher ed in California and the U.S., and wrote a book called The California Idea, which, again, is, I think, the first really coherent approach to looking at how a state developed its higher ed system. And so, Zach, a little on you.
Yeah. Sure. Hi, folks. Thanks all for being here. So my name is Zach Bleemer. I'm an economist, a PhD student in the economics department here at Berkeley, and a visiting scholar at the San Francisco Federal Reserve. And I'm an applied microeconomist with an interest in higher education. So this is one part of a very large research agenda examining the role of higher education in the 21st and 20th centuries in promoting growth and economic mobility in the state of California. So I think we'll start with John giving the sort of macro overview first of the project, and second of the history of the University of California in particular in the macro sense in the 20th century.
Yes, and then you're going to see some very interesting analysis that Zach's doing. And Zach, I'm kind of like the cheerleader. I have some data. I've looked at data over time. But Zach is bringing in a whole different way, very creative, a way in which we can really look at big data. So and in any case, at least the scope of what we're talking about is really from the beginning to now, potentially. In this presentation, we're kind of just using a sampling of data, and it's a little bit more limited, but it's more or less to give you a sense of what is potentially there, just really a new era for us to really do some interesting work on the history of the University of California. So it's dipping our toe in the big data ocean. This is a very popular movement, so we're now part of it as well. And again, as I said, Zach has knowledge and abilities to help us mine this data in ways that are unique and new. So as I say, there are many new possibilities to look at the key historical and contemporary policy issues. And we're also doing this event, and this project links into our interest to do a series of events and research projects that can help us prepare for the 150th anniversary of the University of California, which will be in 2018. So that's a big deal, and I know we have some members, perhaps, of the 150th anniversary committee. Yes, I was careful not to say that word. And so just to give you a sense of the kind of data sets that we can potentially look at, they've always been there, but now there's an ability to digitize them and put them into data banks and do analysis that's much more sophisticated than ever before. But some of the data sets that Zach is looking at and I'm assisting with to some degree is this UCOP corporate state databases. There's information that he's going to provide about faculty and the fields they're in, gender issues, all kinds of things. There's administrative and personnel staff data, operating budgets, capital budgets. And then, you know, it's kind of going from a UC view to a larger set of potential ways to look at higher education in California historically and in contemporary angles. And there's course catalogs, registrars, transcripts, alumni databases, employment data. Also, I think we can mine data from the California Postsecondary Education Commission that once existed and was the coordinating agency for California and higher ed and was the central depository of data, but it was a victim of budget cuts in the Great Recession, and Jerry Brown penciled it out, and it doesn't exist anymore. And there, in fact, is no central data collection now on California higher ed. So there's an ability to potentially resurrect aspects of that, or at least mine the data that they had collected. And so then you get down to California demographics and linkages, which again, I think Zach can talk about in terms of the census, U.S. Census, for example, data that we can link in. And this is the areas that we think at the moment that we're going to look at. These are the policy issues. They aren't mutually exclusive. Higher education access and attainment, socioeconomic mobility, economic impact of high school graduates, and gender and racial equity, these kinds of issues. Again, we'll give you examples of that later down the road, but there's an ability to look at these issues in new ways with the ability to collect data and crunch it. And so, as Zach said, we have a kind of a macro view. What can we tell from large data sets that are already collected, or we can enhance in some way to tell us about the history of UC Berkeley, the UC system in general as it's grown over time, and then obviously California. So this is kind of a broad area, and this is a little bit what I'm going to present, some of the sample data. And then there's this micro approach, which is heavily structured around individual student panel data sets. Do you want to say anything more about the micro side? I'm sorry.
I think I'll hold off for the most part until the second part of the talk. I'll just say that, what we've been able to collect is a tremendous amount of individual student-level data, as well as some sense of where those students end up going from the 1910s, 20s, 30s, and 40s, graduates of the university from a century ago. And so, I'll present some information about that in 20 minutes.
Yeah, okay. So, part one, this is my little part, and then we'll get to Zach's very interesting crunching of data. Mine is very simple, but I do want to say that I think we have an ability to tell the story of UC in a new way by following the data. And I'm going to say a couple of cynical remarks, if I can imagine them, at various points. And then I also say we have to be careful. We don't want to be blinded by the data as well. It's a route to interpretation and analysis. The data is not the only thing. So that's a challenge for us, and what I hope to, give you little samples of, and maybe we can discuss. This is the very simplest data of all, of course, undergraduate and graduate student enrollment at the University of California, I should say. Sorry, it doesn't say that up there, but what I have is UC, and you can see this overall growth rate, and you can link it to various interesting, we can divide it up in many different ways, but you see certain kinds of trends. So, for example, here you see this enrollment growth, which is the GI Bill in the post-veterans period, and this kind of downward slope and going back to a form of normalization. And I do want to say it's an interesting aspect of this because there are ways that we can cut the data up. For example, transfer students or, for example, what we called special admits students. These are students that didn't meet normal university requirements, and there were requirements, grade requirements, not testing in that period. And they accepted huge numbers of students under special admissions, not the regular criteria. And the reason, was to make sure that we were doing our role in enrolling veterans. But there are all of these other things we can look at. Transfer students, I don't show this data, but as early as 1930, around 40% of all the students at Berkeley and UCLA were transfer students, okay? And in fact, if you go, it actually is over 50% with the veterans in this period after World War II. So there are some really interesting aspects of the data. This is very simple. And I will say also we've had very stable admissions policies since the progressive era, basically, in which we've admitted the top 15% of all high school graduates. That was actually a goal. They did analysis about it. If you're aware of the 1960 master plan and what we live with today, it's 12.5%. Interesting, huh? We've actually, in the 1960 master plan, a lot of people think it expanded access. Well, it did in some ways, but in other ways, it restricted access to the University of California. It actually raised admission criteria to push more students to lower cost community colleges. So these are just a few aspects of the data that we can look at that could be very interesting. Now, here's faculty by rank. This obviously The storyline, I just want to say very briefly, is we see one thing I should note is there's a change in how faculty are counted in 1958. So there's a bump in that data set, and this is obviously always a concern when you have large data sets and collecting data, how consistent is the data. But you can also see that there's this general overtime and something we're all familiar with, increasing numbers of lecturers and part-time faculty into the mix. So that's obviously a very important aspect that we see this that you'll see in this other data sets that come up, this shift in who are the faculty and who is doing the majority of teaching. This was simply just to again show this data, change in the status of faculty. And so here's another way to look at it. Here's student undergraduate and graduate to faculty ratios. Now, there is a problem with data like this. For one, in the modern era, at least as far as I understand, if you look at current data on student faculty ratios, they're putting in FTE workload aspects as opposed to headcount. So the historical data is bodies, right? Not full-time equivalents. In other words, we have ways of looking at students, and if there's a student who is taking less than the normal course load, then they're not a full FTE. So this gets into workload aspects and how that's on the student side, but similar with the faculty, part-time versus full-time. This is not disaggregating that. But you see this various shifts and changes and going on here, and you can link them to various eras and differences. Here's the 1930s. While there was a 10% cut in faculty, I think it was roughly about 10%, the actual enrollments went down, I believe, for part of that. But there's so you see some of that linkage. Obviously, here again is the post-World War II GI veterans. But the message I want to tell you is that there's a lot of misunderstanding about the California Master Plan and what it did and did not do. Some people seem to think that there was no such thing as California higher education before 1960, and then there was, as I like to say, a biblical event, and suddenly we had this amazing system. That's not the case at all. Basically, the structure, the tripartite structure that we know of the community colleges, CSU and UC, dates back to the Progressive Era, and it has important changes, and the 1960 Master Plan really reinforces that structure and provides a more regulatory structure around it. But as you can see, one of the things that does happen is there's a lot more budget stability after the Master Plan. And that's really what is partly the great thing about the Master Plan. It created stability in an era of really tremendous population growth. Okay, so here's another way of looking at the data set. Undergraduate as a percentage of all enrollment and latter faculty as a percentage of all faculty. I'm mixing up things a little bit here, but we can see very significant periods of change over time. And, of course, the Wheeler era, this is basically 1899 to 1919, is a tremendous era of growth and of budget stability. I'll come back on the budget very shortly. And reorganization of the UC, of UC Berkeley before UCLA comes on board in 1919. So there's a lot of growth going on in terms of and reorganization of the university. For example, the graduate division, what is now known as the graduate dean, was established in the Wheeler era as part of a reorganization. In this area, we also have the development of lower division and upper division students, which is partly developed in order to promote the community colleges. So the community colleges are a major force coming out in California's overall higher ed system. But this is an important era of change. We see, again, there's a little bit, we have to be careful with the data because there is this major shift in how faculty are counted. I actually don't know all the aspects of that. I just know it's true in the data, so we're going to have to track that down. But you can see this fairly stable period. And then, of course, we see this major shift going on here, right, as I call it, the beginning of the end era. There are a couple of things going on here, and I know we have many people in the room who know that era well, and I know pieces of that era, is that, of course, we do have a major recession in this period. The University of California uses an early retirement program in order to create stability, and so it's exiting out a lot of senior faculty as well to hire cheaper, younger faculty. But at the same time, they're mixing, which we see in every American higher education, but, you know, selective research-intensive universities are different than CSU, teaching-intensive, or community colleges, but you see this general pattern of hiring more and more lecturers to take on the faculty workload. So this is all part of this story. So as to whether it really begins, I mean, in a certain way, we start seeing things happen in the 1980s. Then we have Governor Duke Machen, who works out a deal with David Gardner to put in more money for the University of California, and then we see this. But the other part, you have to also, this doesn't correlate with actual growth in the institution. So in other words, while you're seeing these ratios, what's also happening is the University of California continues to grow dramatically. If you remember that chart where things just keep going up and up. So that's another element in understanding this data.
And I know you may not have the data, but research dollars, grants, and all that, I'm not suffering with the decline of laddering faculty?
Well, that's a very good question, and I don't know the answer to it. I haven't.
I think it would.
Yeah, well.
One would think most lecturers are not.
I actually have.
For major research grants.
Right, we have data. I could show pieces of it, but I don't know if I can fully answer it. Because I need to make sure that Zach gets here and starts talking any minute now. So here's another area that is of interest, of course, is the growth in staff. Again, correlating with the growth in overall students and the number of campuses that we have. So a big issue in the early 60s was in an era before, in an era of growth, it keeps growing, is what is the role of the University of California system-wide office versus the campuses? How much staff is there? So this was a big part of the debate in the early 1960s. But as you can see, scale is so different. And there are a lot of other things going on here because this does include, and one could exclude, the hospitals. So the growth in hospital personnel and costs and funding, I should say, budget, is really dramatic, significant, becomes the single, one single actual expenditure. So this is a piece, I mean, one, I could pull this out. I didn't in this particular chart. But I do think this, and this is a very an issue that's very hot, of course. How many staff do we have compared to administrators? And at least in this data, what I would say is you're seeing this major shift that occurs in this period in which faculty are the dominant numbers, and then they're not. And then this growth over a period, but if you look proportionally, it's in this last several decades, the number of staff have not increased dramatically as a proportion of overall employment. There's a kind of a stability that's occurred in here about the number of staff to faculty. Now, that may change. Obviously, this only goes to 2011. So I only have a couple more slides, and I'm sorry I'm kind of going through them quick because we want to give you a sampling. We're still kind of digesting what it means, these kinds of things. And so this is simply to show you, again, a way that we can look at budget history. There are problems because how they categorized various budgetary operations differs over time. There is some consistency. And the consistency, a lot of it, it comes because in 1968, the University of California had its 100th anniversary. And they spent about 5 years, including Clark Kerr was part of this, but many people, to celebrate the history of the University of California. And as a result, they collected data. They got histories of academic departments. They did amazing work. And we can build off of that. And that's one thing I've tried to message to the campus and the office of the president, is that we have this tremendous base that was created because of Clark Kerr and others to help celebrate the 1968 100th anniversary. By the way, Kerr was then fired before they had he could experience this marvelous event. But they did a lot of work, and we could build off that. So in any case, what you see here is a story of the land-grant university. And the University of California had very little to any appropriations from the state of California. This is proportional, right? So it's not the number. It's just what of 100% of the inadequate or robust budget did the University of California find it, where to get its money? And so you see here the land grant history right here, in which the California got so many acres of land from the federal government that they could sell, put it into endowment. I've always been a little confused about how that all worked, really, because there was some shenanigans going on with that, and it happened in every state. There was some interesting things going on with the land grants. But they used this, and in fact, they assumed early on that the University of California would never need a large allocation from the state of California. We're talking about 1870s, okay? They were really wrong. And they were also didn't understand, the growth rate that California would have and the changes that come with history and all these kinds of things. Though you start seeing this change, and one of the reasons there's such volatility here is there was no really set pattern as to how this university should be budgeted. It was actually a proportion of tax, a property tax income that the state got at that time. So there's a lot of volatility to this. This is now to show you the endowments fade away. This is the endowment amount that came from the federal government's land grant. And you see this growth in the overall state budget in an era, again, of tremendous growth. You're starting to see real enrollment growth in the 1890s. And then into the turn of the century, as you saw in my earlier chart, this kind of gigantic onward growth that goes with the growth of the state of California. And that's the only other thing I want to emphasize. When you're talking about the history of the University of California, you're not talking about just, you know, how good it is and how it's organized and all these things, but we've always grown with the state's population, and we have a mandate to do that. And one question is, can we sustain that in the new budgetary environment? So, again, you can see various things going on. One interesting aspect is that you have this bump that relates in part, I believe, to from the federal government, that relates in part to the Manhattan Project and the beginnings of the National Labs. I'm not absolutely sure. And there are people in the room who may know or have an ability to analyze this differently than I can. Also, I want you to note the student fee numbers. So people have this imagery that student fees have not been a component of the university's economic health over time. And it is true after the 50s and into the 60s, it becomes more and more small. But it's actually had a role in various points. This bump is, again, the GI Bill. That GIs would get money, they could go to the institution of their choice that was accredited. And that's still been the model. Hillary's got a different vision as to maybe how that would work. But this is simply, again, showing these kinds of historical differences. And then finally, that's the same slide, isn't it? Yeah. So I didn't say this, but one really interesting aspect, and I didn't create the stability quite that I thought, but up to 1911, as I said before, the state of California budgeted UC on a percentage of property tax largely, and it was it wasn't adequate. It was not clear. It didn't relate to the university's need to grow, and a budget deal was worked out in a very unusual fashion, because it was kind of a mistake, to tell you the truth, and then they figured out they had to somehow figure out how to fund the University of California. And this is the beginning of workload funding, the concept that the state of California would provide X amount of money for every student that you had. It didn't exist before 1911. And then finally, this is just a picture of UC's budget history from 1950 to 1990, and I think I'm just going to skip quickly so that we can get to Zach's part of the presentation. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, John. Okay, let's take like a two-minute break from data. try to digest what we've just learned. So it's worth stepping back and thinking about our goals as we're looking at these time trend histories of the University of California. The goals were projected right in the beginning of this presentation, right? So we have basically four, I think, general questions of interest when it comes to studying this university. The first question is about access to higher education in California. The second question is the role of the University of California in promoting economic and technological growth in the state. The third question is about economic mobility, right, and how access leads to changing people's class status in the state. The fourth question, then, finally, is about gender and ethnic equality, Right? The university has been open to women and members of all races since the university was founded. Right? This is despite the fact that, for instance, at Stanford University, right, Stanford had a cap of 500 total female students from 1899 to the mid-1930s, right, which meant that by 1934, only 10 to 15% of Stanford students were women. I'll show you in a moment that anywhere between 30 and 50% of University of California students have been women since the university was founded in the 1880s. So these are sort of the general four questions that we're interested in. And then it's worth thinking about, okay, to what degree does the macro data that we've just presented answer those questions? Right? So, okay, so you think about student to faculty ratios, that gives you a sense of the quality of education at the university. You look at budgets, that gives you a sense of the cost of that education both to students and to the general public through state grants. These are all sort of oblique ways of answering these central questions of interest, but none of them quite get to the point of, okay, here we have a century worth of information about a university. What has this university done to or for the state? That's where I entered this project. So I entered this project as an economist who's interested in the role of the university in creating the California that we, I don't know, enjoy now. Right? I was driven by this initial, I think, really marvelous fact that as of 1900, California was the 21st most populous state in the country. Right? There were 20 states with more people than California in 1900. Today, California is half again as big as any other U.S. state. It accounts for 10% of U.S. GDP. It's been a tremendous amount. It's been a very successful state. It also had a very unique public education system. And there's a question of just what is the interplay between these two facts about the University of California in the 20th century. The way that I have approached this question is by collecting individual microdata, so student level or professor level or, say, high school teacher or doctor level data about people in the state over the last century, using new digitization technology that allows us to build massive data sets using publications that are now 100 years old. I'm going to start by running through a couple of charts that I think still are sort of focusing on this oblique question of what's happening at the university before then turning to how what's happening at the university impacts the state. So first, consider the faculty. We've already seen tremendous growth of the faculty. We've seen a changing distribution of how faculty, the ranking of faculty at the university. Where I'm going to start is departments. Right? So what the way that you construct data like this is by building year by year complete data sets of all faculty at, this is just UC Berkeley, from 1900 until 2011. These are extracted from course catalogs that were published by the university annually until 2011, at which point they decided the paper wasn't worth it, which actually makes my data collection impossible. So what you can see in this graph, these are sort of stacked sections of the university, right? If you want to look at, I don't know, sort of big changes in this period. So here we have the creation of UC Davis and the agriculture program, which at the time was part of UC Berkeley. And so you see a big expansion of that sort of top section, which is the professional school professors. Big expansion as the agriculture school grows. What I found particularly interesting about this graph is the slow shrinking of the humanities, right? So if you look at the proportion of professors in the humanities in 1900, this was about 25 to 30% of the UC faculty, right? So that's the range between these two lines here, right? The dark line being the humanities line. And so if you look at that contemporarily, it's between 15 and 20%. So it's not quite halved, but it's almost halved as a proportion of the size of the university. Where has that gone? Well, the social sciences have grown somewhat, and STEM fields have grown a lot. So you can see a big increase in the engineering fields just after the Second World War. This is both an expansion of already existing engineering fields, as well as the introduction of a number of new fields of nuclear engineering, aeronautical engineering, et cetera. So you can see a big increase in engineering at that point. So again, we're still only obliquely answering questions. We can, again, obliquely answer questions by looking at the proportion of courses taught at the University of California. So again, how would you get data like this? You open up a course catalog. You take pictures of every page of a course catalog. You digitize that into computer-readable text, and then you teach a computer to identify patterns in that text. Anytime there's a number followed by a period, followed by a professor's name, followed by a paragraph of text, that's a course. Assign that course to the most recently identified department. That means that that course is being taught in that department. Assign it to the teacher that's listed in the course description. It turns out that while somewhat challenging, this is all wholly feasible using contemporary computation technology. And so, right, so what you end up with is a chart like this. One thing I'll note is that I'm showing a lot of digitization data today. There is student data, there's professor data, there's course data. The course data is the noisiest. So no, there's reason to expect that there would be error as the computer is reading through these courses. The student data, I've done a lot of cross-validation on. I think that's very high quality. The course data still has some work to go. One thing that I can't explain is this peculiar, like, 3-year bump in the number of engineering courses at UC Berkeley. I don't think that's real. I think that there's some error in the way that the computer is reading this data. Nevertheless, these long-term trends, I think, are real. So one thing that you'll notice is that while the proportion of faculty who are in the humanities has shrunk considerably since 1900, that's not the case for the number of courses offered in the humanities. What this means is that two things have changed, right? That both professors may be teaching more courses, and the average size of courses has shrunk, while the proportion of students studying the humanities has only slightly shrunk. So yes, question here.
Are courses listed or courses taught?
Oh, these are courses listed. Note that there will be some courses that may appear in multiple departments. That would mean that they were doubly counted. I see. That's a good question.
So that doesn't represent.
That is true. I agree. So yes, these are courses listed, not courses. Yeah, that's a good point that I had not thought about at all. Yes. Yeah. Thank you for that. Yes, these are courses. Information is available in these course catalogs about when the courses were taught, right? So it will say, right, taught in the spring of a certain year by a certain professor. That is information that I have not used. And I don't know. Thank you very much. Let me move on from this slide because I think it's just become substantially less interesting. yeah.
The challenge of this kind of data, and I think I might say, though, that if you could look at the when it was being taught, I sense, but I could be wrong, that catalogs were more truthful in this era than in the modern era, but I'm not sure if that's true.
Yeah. That's an empirical question that has an empirical answer. Yeah. Thank you for that. So a last thing to think about with faculty before we step back and think about what to do with this data. So here we have the proportion of faculty who are men and women, not only at UC Berkeley, but also at Stanford University, which also has their course catalogs available online, and UCLA. So a couple of things to note here. First, remember that UCLA entered the UC system as an active teachers college, which explains why when it entered the university, since that teachers college remained open, the proportion of faculty who were women was very high. Most of those women were actually practicing teachers, who, in addition to teaching elementary or secondary school, were also teaching as faculty members at the Teachers College in UCLA. And the proportion of those teachers swiftly declines through the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So that's one thing that's happening here. A second thing to note is the jump in the proportion of female faculty at UC Berkeley around the Second World War. So it increases as men went to war, and then decreases again as those men come back. You'll see a similar pattern for students in that era. And then you'll also notice that the proportion of female faculty has historically been very low, but has been rising pretty steadily since the 1970s. It's rising faster at the public universities than at Stanford, a private university, and indeed is very similar today between UC Berkeley and UCLA. So, taking a step back, what could you do with data like this? So what do you know? You know the courses that are listed in a given year. You know who taught those courses, so you can link course to faculty. Imagine you also had student transcripts, right? So imagine you also knew which courses students took in given years. That information is available from college registrars. In that case, you would know which professors those students had and could follow those students after graduation. So if you were, for instance, interested in the role of having a diverse faculty at Berkeley, right? Even in the, say, the 1930s and 40s, when females were a very small proportion of faculty, if you could get some sorts of random variation. Some people take the same course from female faculty, some people take it from male faculty. And you could look at, say, the long-term prospects. What happens to these people 20, 30, 40 years after they graduate from the university? Right? If you really want to quantify what having a diverse faculty does to the state, this is the data that you would need in order to do that analysis, in addition to more specific information, first about students, and second about those students once they become alumni. So with that in mind, let me turn to some student data.
One thing going back to the day, because you brought this up, is look at this high percentage of UCLA female, relatively high, comparatively. And you had said, this is why I'm excited by some of this data, because I have certain knowledge or things from my own historical work or assumptions that, that still UCLA was a teacher's college up to 1919, and that it would still be male-dominated. But this shows indicators that that legacy in some form at least had female, yeah, a high proportion of female teachers in the teacher's college. Anyway, I'm just noting that because it is, how do you explain that significant difference between the campuses?
Sure.
Yeah, that's true.
Before you yes. go on,
No, very much no. So I've today's talk, I'm focusing mostly on Berkeley because that happens to be the campus that I'm sitting in. I've been doing some work with the Office of the President that's looking at other UC campuses, and I've also been collecting a substantial amount of data about California private universities outside of the UC system. So I showed a little bit of information about Stanford. I think I'll have some more to say both about Stanford and USC coming up. But I'm interested in the role of higher education in the state, where the UC system and Berkeley in particular are, I think, really notable and interesting examples of that broader project. But today, I think, for the most part, focusing on Berkeley. So now consider students. So what this map shows is towns that sent at least 5 students to either Berkeley or Stanford, but Stanford at this time was very small, so mostly Berkeley in 1900. So what you'll notice is, first of all, I think there are a surprising number of towns. They may be located mostly around these two main urban areas of San Francisco and Los Angeles, but there are a large number of students from relatively rural areas of the state who are attending the University of California even 115 years ago. So it turns out in 1900, roughly 25% of the California population lived in rural areas, and about 20% of students at the University of California were from rural areas, which I think is surprisingly high. If you then compare the 1900 numbers to 1930 numbers, you'll notice a couple of changes. The first change is the tremendous increase in the number of towns that are sending students to these schools. First, because there are so many more students attending the school. Second, because of broad population growth across California. But third, because of this increasing focus on recruiting and obtaining students from rural areas to attend the university. I think a very interesting question is, how do students from these rural areas end up at Berkeley? I'll have a little bit to say about that towards the end of this talk. The last thing I'll point out here is the shading of these circles. So very light circles are areas that sent mostly male students to the university, whereas darker areas sent mostly female students to the university. And what I'd like to point out is that it turns out there's tremendous heterogeneity in those shadings across areas. There are rural areas that send mostly women and rural areas that send mostly men. There are urban areas that are similarly segregated. What this is to say is that there's just a tremendous amount of variation in these towns, which for an economist, so right, this is where I sort of slowly put on my economist hat, that's very exciting. Anytime there's variation, that means there's testable implications of that variation. You could compare towns that send mostly women to towns that send mostly men, and this gives you some sense of what the university is differentially doing for different groups of people. So to quickly go through some demographic information about these students, so the left panel uses my individual level student data on the proportion of students who are female. The right panel is just to give you a sense, starting in 1946 to present, of what those trends look like across California. That's because I don't have student data after 1946. I have to focus on this early region for a number of reasons that I hope will become looser over time as I'm able to obtain more recent student-level information. However, what I want to point out here about UC Berkeley is that at a time when only about a third of university students across the country were female, it was much higher at the University of California. So anywhere between, for the most part, 40 and 50% of university students at that time, even between 1900 and 1940, were women. You can see peaks in that during the First World War, and I actually don't show it here, but there's a tremendous peak during the Second World War when the men tend to go off to war. So you can look at similar demographic information about major selection. So same thing, University of California on the left, contemporary all California data on the right. So the first thing, I think the most striking thing about this graph, which shows the proportion of men and women who major in either STEM fields, which is engineering, pre-medicine, or chemistry, STEM fields, and as well as the business fields as an undergrad. Right, so you can see a tremendous drop-off in STEM study in around 1910. This comes from the shrinking of the School of Mining. I don't know, we stopped teaching mining, essentially, and the students who used to study mining, for whatever reason, moved to non-STEM majors. And you can also see a big growth in the School of Business during that period. The other thing I'd like to point out is while the proportion of women studying STEM and business fields was relatively small throughout this period, it was non-zero and, in fact, non-negligible. Right? So there were at least dozens, and in many cases hundreds, of women who were studying fields that at that time were very strongly dominated by men, despite the fact that most women at this time were in university in the sort of standard college of letters, as well as social sciences and some in the natural sciences. So you can see some growth around the First World War in the proportion of women studying business fields. That tapers off a bit, but it's I don't know, I think quite large. I thought surprisingly so. So, again, what's relevant about all of this? All I'm trying to show you is here is information about students that we have. We know where they come from. We know what gender they are. Soon, I have an undergraduate working on figuring out what ethnicity or race they are. We know what they studied in school. And now let's think about what we know about them after they leave school. So here, as promised, is a map showing all of the high schools in the state of California in 1910. And each high school is represented by a pie chart. It's probably a bit hard to see out there. I apologize. Where the pie charts represent the proportion of teachers at these high schools who were trained by the University of California. So these come from annual registers that were published of all high school teachers in the state. And you can see that between a third and a half of all high school teachers in the state of California in 1910 were trained to be teachers at the University of California, which at that time was all UC Berkeley. There were no other UC programs. Right, Stanford teaches about half that proportion, and then a number of other universities, including out-of-state schools, taught the remainder of these teachers. But you can see this is sort of one tremendous benefit of the University of California to the state. It's educating the state's educators. A second benefit that I'd like to point out is in doctors. So medical schools, in tendency in the early 20th century, accepted very, very few women. This was not true at the University of California. Between 10 and 15% of University of California medical students were women. This map shows the year in which the first female doctor arrives in California towns across the state. Right? So ranging from 1900 to 1930, the lighter circles are towns that received their first female doctor later. What's interesting about this, right, so almost all of these female doctors were trained by the University of California. And so you should think about, okay, what does this tremendous expansion of female medicine in the state do to the state? How does this change people's behavior? Now that I've shown you a sense of what data we have, what data we're looking to collect, as an economist, I'm obligated to include one regression table in every talk. I'm not going to talk through most of this regression table, but I'll give you a sense of one project that I've worked on using this data, which is an event study model around the arrival of women, female high school teachers or female doctors, to rural California communities. So here's the relevant question. You're a young 15-year-old high school girl. You're going to high school. You're in a rural California community. You've likely never met a woman who went to college. Right? And now, for the first time, your high school hires a chemistry or physics teacher who is female, or hires a doctor who is female. Right? The question is, how does this change your behavior? Are you more likely to go to college? Are you more likely to study in a STEM field? Are you more likely to end up becoming a doctor or a teacher yourself? These are all questions that are very easily answerable using this data. Right? I know when the female doctor arrives in a town. I know which students end up in university because they self-report which town they come from. So I can see, does the proportion of students from towns that obtain this first female STEM professional increase after the arrival of that professional? The answer is yes. The answer is that it's a very, very large increase, though somewhat short-lived. So what you see is a 10 percentage point increase in the likelihood of a woman's going to college the year that a female, or actually the year after, a female physics or chemistry high school teacher arrives in a town. And so this roughly works out to, in general, in 1900 or 1910 or 1920, about 5% of young people in California went to college. This is a 1 to 2 percentage point increase in the likelihood of a woman's going to college. So, right, so from, say, 5 to 6% of women across California are going to college because of the introduction of what you might think of as a role model effect, the arrival of female STEM professionals that otherwise that are providing information to young women in rural towns that otherwise is unavailable. So this is just one sense of a project that would that could, I think that this kind of data could foster. Okay, I'm going to cut off there. There's a slide that just shows data that we have, things that we're working on, and goals that we have to move this research forward, keeping in mind the broad interests of the project. But we're really interested in hearing what everyone thinks about, questions that you think this data could answer, data that you think might be available. We're looking for thoughts, and we turn to you. Yes.
We asked David Hollinger to take a look at our slides and to provide a comment. And David is a very well-known, respectable historian here at Berkeley.
I wish I could listen to what I'm about to say then. But since there are a lot of people here and there's not much time and there are many questions, I'll just confine myself to two observations. One is about the relation between the forthcoming celebration of the 150th and the centennial in 1968. Now, what we have here is the making of a account of the history of the university, which is many times over richer and more interesting than what was publicized at the time. Now, it's true that Clark Kerr and his friends collected a lot of stuff, but if you look at the volume that came out, the Centennial History in 1968, it's very spare. There's not very much in it, and actually the public celebration didn't amount to much. I was an instructor that year myself in the history department, and I can assure you there was very little attention to it. The campus was very much disagreeing about the role of universities in society and in politics. So as a result of that, the administration decided not to make a big deal of the celebration. Now, this time, we'll presumably have more of the constituencies of the university willing to share an interest in this, so I would hope that we could have a really first-class celebration in history come out of this. So there's a huge difference between what's about to happen next year, 2 years from now, and what was the case in 1968. Second point that I want to make, second observation, has to do with what I found the most surprising about this presentation. Now, there are many things here that are sort of consistent with what's known in other studies nationally about what's going on, so I won't comment on that. The most surprising thing to me is that I didn't see any effort whatsoever to measure knowledge production and to make some analysis of the relative role of the University of California in knowledge production worldwide and nationally. And if you were to find, for example, that of the scholarly papers and books that are cited more than, say, 50 times, that the University of California faculty accounts for X percentage of those in a particular field, and you can break it down. I mean, I did a study of the University of Michigan from 1938 to 1988, concluding, for example, that the math department was very good at topology, but not much else, that the philosophers were mostly doing ethical theory. I mean, you can break that down so that you have a more of an intellectual history that's consistent with the kind of methodology that you're doing here, can tell you an awful lot. And it's also relevant to some of the goals that you mentioned in terms of explaining to the public and their elected representatives what role this university plays in knowledge production worldwide.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. Okay.
Comment on.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Hold on. We need to have recorded because we're.
The Chronicle of Philanthropy has a lot of data now on private foundation support for U.S. colleges and universities. I think it's a great data set that can be mined.
Okay. Thank you. I'm Nils Gilman. I'm in the Chancellor's office. So this is a really interesting presentation. The question I want to ask builds on David's last comment, and I want to preface it by saying that I think we need to be careful about having a strictly instrumentalist view of the university and the value it provides to the state. With that said, if we are going to take an instrumentalist view, I think it would be really interesting to try to figure out what are the impacts, the economic impacts of the university on the growth of the state's economy. I think that it's one thing just to measure papers and output and so on, but the question is, are these papers actually producing anything? So that's one thing that one could think about, how one measures the impact. How often are these cited in patent filings for entrepreneurial firms? The second thing would be, what is the impact of a research university on the students themselves? And I just want to name what I think is the public policy question that's at stake here. We have a governor right now, but also many people in Sacramento who are wondering, why should they pay so much for the University of California? Isn't it good enough to have a Cal State system? What is the incremental value that's added to the state by having high-powered research universities as opposed to teaching-intensive universities? And if we can figure out ways to create data that actually shows the value in an instrumental way to the state of investing in research universities, that would be a powerful thing to be,
sure,
for us to be able to do in Sacramento.
So, that's a question that I think about a lot. Here's a project that would answer that question, maybe not in the way that that you would like, but I think it would provide a pretty nice answer to that question. So I think the way instrumentally that I would think about what we're asking is, what is the value to students of attending, say, the UC system as opposed to attending CSU? So right, how does this change those students? And then how does it change the environment in which those students live? So how does it change their parents or their local communities? How does it change wherever those students end up? Right, so you can sort of look for spillovers or ripple effects of those students. Here's one way of testing that. Try to find similar students right before they apply to college, one of whom is accepted to UC and the other who is not. Right, follow those students for 15 years and see first what has happened to the student who was accepted to UC. Right, how are their outcomes different? And second, how has this differentially impacted the communities from which these students came? That's a question that I think, until very recently, was wholly empirically intractable. And given data that the university has collected now, I think is a very tractable question, where you could very literally, I think, using a standard economic research framework, find these quote-unquote identical students, compare their outcomes 15 years later, and then compare the communities they're from. Now, this doesn't directly answer the question of what is the value of the research university. Instead, it answers the sort of more brunt force question, which is, what is the value of UC as it stands relative to other universities? And I think we'd find that the value is quite high.
Just to add a little bit, another area of potential data mining is extension courses. What extension courses are today and what they were historically is a bit different because they were originally focused on agriculture and influencing agricultural development, which was the dominant industry until about 1920, I think, in California. So that's an aspect that we could maybe take a look at extension. And I think they have a pretty complete data set. Other questions? Oh, yes, way in the back.
As this data is being digitized, what steps are being taken to make it both broadly available and structured so that it can be broadly useful for a larger community to address questions?
Yeah. That's a great question. So I see Charlie jumping out of his seat to answer that question. So as of right now, how does this data exist? Well, it exists on like my local hard drive and a couple of backups. And I think my expectation is that it will exist that way for a short time more as I sort of finish up this initial analysis that I've been working towards. Once it's in a reasonably usable and public form, my initial plan is to make it available to the Office of the President and to the center here. So that it's available at least to UC Berkeley researchers and to the staff at the Office of the President who can use this for their analysis, and then to slowly open up access to more and more groups. So I think it's very valuable and interesting data. And the reason, honestly, the only reason that I am not just immediately making it available now is for purely selfish reasons. That it turns out it's data that is extremely costly to produce. And I'm intending to extract sort of as much as I can out of it, I think in the public interest, but ultimately in the academic interest, before making it broadly available, though that is certainly a plan for the future.
Well, what I'd say, too, also is the concept, at least from what we've discussed, is that it would really come up to contemporary times. We didn't show anything in terms of contemporary data. I did have a budget picture for you, but it was too complicated because it gets more complicated, more resources. The DOE is huge and medical centers and all that. So, there are some issues related to how contemporary it is. I would hope we could bring it up to almost now. And then how much are we paying attention to that? But, you know, I would think that eventually it could have a public access side as long as we're following all privacy issues, FERPA, these kinds of things, which we're trying to look at a little bit more.
Yeah.
Maybe one more question because we need to close up. No? Oh, sorry, Karen.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I don't need a mic, I don't think, for this.
No, you have.
I'm curious about your early, especially the early period you're working on, your sources of data for ethnicity of students.
And sure.
Particularly students, but also faculty.
Absolutely.
So I want you to describe how you would actually extract that data.
So here's the game. I open up a volume published in 1900 that lists all students who attended the University of California in that year. It lists their last name, comma, first name. It lists their self-reported hometown, their local address, their major, and their year in school. These were published as the effectively directories that students could look up each other's addresses. Take that book, photograph each page, digitize the text so that it's computer readable. Teach a computer that anytime you have a word, comma, a word, that's probably last name, comma, first name at the beginning of a line. And so find all of the students in the book. Now you've got a table where the table shows all of the first and last names. The last question is, right, how do you learn more about these students? Gender is easy, right? It turns out first names in 1900 are extremely indicative of people's gender. You can match them essentially to proportional numbers from the Social Security Administration at the time. What proportion of people born in 1900 were John? If most of them are men, call all the Johns men, et cetera. You do this for 4,000 names and you're done. Ethnicity is a little more challenging. There are two ways that we could learn the ethnicities of these students. One is that publicly available to researchers right now are all U.S. censuses conducted in 1940 and earlier. So I have one undergraduate student sitting right here who's working on linking my student records to the U.S. Census, which provides race information. A second thing you can do, also I have an undergraduate working on this, is to use a machine learning algorithm. So essentially, right, teach a computer to learn, based on individuals' first, middle, and last name, what ethnicity they are. Now, while that might be somewhat challenging contemporarily, in 1900, again, that's really easy. So what are the relevant ethnic groups at that time? There were almost no Black or Hispanic students at the University of California in 1900. There were Japanese students, there were Chinese and Korean students. But there were also relevant differences between Italian students and Irish students and Jewish students, et cetera. And you can teach a machine learning algorithm using the entire U.S. Census, right? So you give it the U.S. Census, you say, all the names that are identified as Irish in the U.S. Census, those are the Irish ones. Compare them to all of the names that aren't. And then tell me, based on the first and last names in the student register, what is the likelihood for each of these individuals that they are Irish? And then you could put together a data set that effectively, it doesn't quite have the student's ethnicity, but it almost or effectively has these students' ethnicities, which I think is extremely accurate through at least the 1940s. So that's how I'm working on this.
So I think that's, there are problems, but it's very interesting that we can do this kind of work, and Zach is really taking a lead in figuring out what data sets we should look at. We have to wrap up so that you can get lunch and that we keep it in a suitable time frame of the presentation. It will be posted on YouTube eventually via the center. And I also just wanted, my final remark is just to say a bit what Nils said. We don't want to be blinded by the data. You know, we're at the early stages of, and Zach is at the early stages of seeing what data sets we can collect and for what purpose. I think, you know, there are a variety of purposes it could be used for. But generally, the concept is that data doesn't tell you anything. You have to interpret it. And so to what effect? So that's the bigger challenge to a degree is interpreting it. So with that, thank you very much for coming.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.